Hello and welcome to Pratfalls of Parenting episode 23. That's right, 23. Take that, all you naysayers who said I'd never make it past episode 22. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen. Before we get into this conversation with playwright Sam Graber, I wanted to mention a couple of things. In a few weeks, I'm going to be moderating a panel for the Giant Steps Conference, which is a really fun coming together of entrepreneurs and creative types and people just sharing ideas. There's workshops, there's panels, and I have a panel with a bunch of really cool people talking about entrepreneurship, creativity, and parenting, and all how those go together. So if you guys are going to be in Minneapolis on November 16th, you should go to giantstepsmn.org and register and come and check that out. Also, you can comment on the show. You can send us info, questions, feedback, Facebook page. You can like that. You guys know all that stuff, so go ahead and check that out. I really enjoyed this conversation with Sam about art, work, and parenting. He had a lot of really interesting things to say about separating his work from his family life and prioritizing. So I hope everybody enjoys it. And so without further ado, here's my conversation with playwright Sam Graber.
We make cool stuff, we make people too. How has that affected you? Along the way, we try to stay creative types at the end of the day. Kids get in the way. They cause the worst and best of days. There's nothing wrong with venting about the pratfalls of parenting. Children are unrelenting, which causes pratfalls of parenting. Constantly reinventing because of pratfalls of parenting. The podcast.
I thought we could rehash some stuff since we lost the recording. Right. So forgive me if it sounds like retry ground.
No, no.
Several months ago. So
yeah, I forgot. I didn't remember what you looked like. I just was like, whoa.
I don't think
No, but I remember verbatim every word that ever comes out of my mouth. And
good. That's very normal. Doesn't make you seem like a sociopath at all. It seems totally fine. Awesome. Well, I sincerely thank you for sitting down with me again. We did have the conversation in, was it like spring? I think we talked in the spring.
It might have been like late spring, early summer at the Playwright Center.
Yeah.
I was doing a seminar.
Oh, that's right.
That
night.
On technology and playwriting.
Right.
And you were so gracious to come and, you know, do the interview right.
And less gracious to not get the recording properly.
Right.
So it just, well, it was just for us, essentially.
Right.
So that, I think that's good. It was a good chance for us to talk as a warm up.
Right, right.
But for the purposes of the recording, I'll say I'm talking to Sam Graber.
Graber, correct.
Good, I think I remembered that it wasn't because Graber. You'd need another B to be Graber.
Here's the thing. So I went to University of Maryland, undergrad, and I played hockey.
Oh, nice.
For the team. And, of course, they butcher or mispronounce my name.
Yeah.
You know, and so the enunciation is Graber instead of Graber.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the team's just kind of on the ice and everybody's, you know, going through the roster and they hear the cat go, Graber, and I go, Graber. And all the other guys just looked at me and went, Graber.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
So for the rest of my, you know, undergraduate career, the nomenclature went to the, you know, short A and the long B, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was...
Well, on a sports team, you have to have some nickname. So it could have been a lot worse.
Unfortunately, that spread beyond just the rank.
Of course.
And so it went to most of the women. Mm. And so there were like times when I would walk in, they'd go Graber. And then it was kind of like an advance warning against like
there's some connotations. Yeah,
and, like,
that's bad.
Physical molestation with this guy. And so it just kind of destroyed my...
Nice.
Yeah.
I have to say, I appreciate you getting into molestation right away at the top of this.
You know, and this is about parenting. For people joining or going... He's already said molestation.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah, well, you have kids. You want to make sure you're aware of, you know, what could happen.
Right.
What better way than to experience it?
Although, I'm assuming most of the people listening to this are already parents. They're not.
I don't know.
They're not considering parenting and going, gee.
Pass.
Yeah. Right.
It might not be a bad idea. I think it's there's some insights into whether you want to do that or not.
I'm just turning this off.
And Sam's turning off his phone, which is nice. 1 minute into.
All right. I've already
very common in as a playwright.
Pause. Right. My phone is on, and I've talked about molestation.
Good. Yeah, you're ticking your boxes of things. You had things you wanted to do.
Right. Next, it will just be a steady stream of like my criminal activity.
So you're a playwright.
I am.
That is your primary art form.
Yes.
You do other writing as well, I think. To some, do you other things?
I don't.
It's just all playwriting.
That's true. I know a lot of playwrights who pursue playwriting as the primary vocation,
mm-hmm.
but then also will do, you know, magazine or journal
mm-hmm.
writing on commission or editing.
Yeah,
they'll also dabble in essays. I at this point, I'm just focused solely on playwriting.
Nice. Well, I like that laser-like focus. It seems like a solid plan.
An email.
Well, yeah.
I'm like a huge email writer.
But do you worry about story structure in an email? Is it
no,
the same?
I worry about the spell checker changing. You know, all my words.
You don't get any choices with spell checker. It doesn't let you have any sort of creative license.
No, spell checker's a rigid bastard.
It's very true.
No, it's just playwriting.
Yeah,
I focus primarily on playwriting and a lot of my playwriting time. Maybe it's surprising for people who are not playwrights. The majority of my time is not spent on dialogue.
Hmm.
It's spent on structure and research. So I'd spend about minimum 2/3 of my time as a playwright in background research, interviews, data collection, and development of structure, story, character outlines, treatments, beating up the treatments. There's a play I'm working on now that's going to go up in May here in town. I'm just starting writing it now after a year of sort of mental deliberation.
Yeah, it sounds like you kind of break the story is where a lot of your energy goes into. And then the actual like getting it all into shape is kind of flows after that. Is
right.
Kind of what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah. I like that process. It's weird for me because I write shows and plays, and my process more and more has become I'm usually a part of the show as well. Like I'll perform or I'll be in the room for rehearsals, and it gets reshaped a lot in there. So I'm always curious about the more sort of I don't know typical variety where you write a thing and then you need to communicate everything on the page. Like I can take some shortcuts and know I can be there too.
Well, you have a more serialized or episodic approach, right? You perform regularly.
Yeah.
So you're sort of comedy writing for, if I may say, sketch, almost sketch-like.
Kind of. I mean, we're not doing the same. There's a story. Usually each show we do has a story to it. So there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, we'll cram as many jokes as we can into there, but we like to have a narrative arc as well.
Yep.
Often what happens is we start off with a premise, fill it with jokes, and then realize later on that we have created this good story throughout, just sort of by instinct or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We're talking about my writing process. That's not what I wanted to get into at all. I feel like you redirected. You're not a lawyer.
Sorry.
No.
Let's move checkbox number 3. No, this is about parenting.
Whatever. But so you mentioned Maryland, and you I think in our talking before you mentioned you music was sort of more your initial foray into art.
Musical theater, right?
Yeah.
So I grew up. I was born in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
I grew up outside D.C. I'm one of the few people who stayed in D.C. longer than 4 years, right? I spent the first 25 years of my life in Washington, D.C. area. And then after being heavy into musical theater, I was subsidizing, you know, my desire with a day job.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I realized as a musical theater practitioner, I would never have things like insurance or a roof,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So then... ultimately,
and you were doing a sort of business,
right? I was working for a Beltway Bandit during the day,
mm-hmm.
and I realized, you know, I'm gonna just go into business, and so I went to business school, and somehow I got accepted into a highly ranked business school,
mm-hmm.
And even though my grades and you know my boards were mediocre, I guess the interview,
mm-hmm.
you know, tipped them over, and maybe because my interest was not. You know, going into investment banking in New York or sort of, you know, the M&A shops. but I wanted to go into entertainment management, that persuaded the school to take me. So I went to Vanderbilt, and then out of Vanderbilt, I had two job offers, thankfully. This is 2001. Hmm. The first job offer was to go into Big Five Consulting in New York City, or the other was to work for Best Buy, mm-hmm. the corporate headquarters. And I chose the second, the latter, which is how I ended up here. And of course, all my friends and family in the Mid-Atlantic were like, Minaware? Like, they're kind of like, where is this on a map? You know, and I called Minnesota, you know, I was joking with, you know, my friends and family back home. And I joked, I said, well, just, it's dangerously close to Iowa. That's how you have to, you know, that's how you characterize where I'm going. So I moved here, and then, of course, I got here in August of 2001, mm-hmm. and then that's when I started at Best Buy, and of course, a month later was 9/11, mm-hmm. and where I would have worked in New York City was basically decimated.
Yeah.
Not structurally, but economically.
Yeah.
So in hindsight, it was a crazy, you know, decision, in a good way.
Yeah.
That I came here. And then, of course, I met my wife, and she's from here, so, you know, I'm stuck here forever. And now we have two kids. I have a 3-year-old girl mm-hmm. and a 1-year-old boy.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome.
Right.
So what pushed you? I mean, you were doing musical theater, and then you were really, you know, you decided to focus really on the economy, like, you know, making
business,
making your living and being in business.
Right.
Were you still doing any writing or anything creative at that time, or you kind of dropped all that stuff?
It's a great question. So no, after a year and a half at Best Buy, I decided I was going to quit, which mm-hmm. was another insane decision, right? Because yeah. I didn't know that many people here.
Yeah.
And I started a theatrical publishing company that was distributing integrated arts materials direct to K-8 classrooms. Mm. So I was selling, I was everything. I was creating, developing, packaging, marketing, and distributing direct to both core classroom teachers and then art specialists.
And what kind of content was, what was that content?
Musical
like?
Theater.
So was it plays?
Correct.
Music and words? And
correct. And we were essentially converting rote core instruction into engaging an activity-based musical theater. Mm. So it was, and it came in the form of a box or a kit. I called them class play kits. And any teacher with zero experience could basically open up this kit and put on a show in their classroom as a substitute for teaching things like the American Revolution or, you know, out of a textbook. They could use ours as an activity-based curriculum source.
Yeah.
So I did that for 6 years. I developed a pretty large curriculum, considering how difficult it was to create the materials for a variety of reasons, which I don't get into, but it is parenting related in the sense that it was developmental. You know,
yeah.
I was putting together material that was meant to be instructional.
Yeah.
And even though I wasn't a parent at the time I started it, I was basically working for, in some ways, parents because they were the ones putting up the money to buy the materials through the PTAs and PTOs. And you know, I was in a lot of classrooms, and I was dealing with a lot of kids. I'm very thankful to the Hopkins School District, who beta tested a lot of my material before I made it, you know, available nationwide in the catalog.
So, when you were doing that work, how much of your actual work was administrative, and how much were you feeling like you were actually kind of doing anything creative?
That's a great question. So, probably a third.
Not that you can necessarily, you know, I'm sure there's a, you know, there's plenty of creativity in administrative work, and there's plenty of boring.
What do you mean, the artistry?
I think kind of artistic. Yeah.
I did all the music, so I wrote all the music. I arranged all the music. I music directed it, and then I basically worked with the playwrights who were doing obviously the playwriting, right on the book. The way it was structured is such that the book could be done without the music, so you did not need the music necessarily to push forward the story or to go ahead with the show. Mm-hmm. However, what it ended up turning out is that that's all the kids loved. Because we were doing, you know, big rock music and making it fun. So,
Do you have, like, educational rock opera? Is it in that vein at all? The Who's Civil War?
Right. In a sense, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the style of the music was The Who's Pompeii. Mm-hmm. So there was a show called Fire of Vesuvius, which was taught 5th and 6th graders, depending on where we were in the country and whether ancient civilization was 5th or 6th grade, about the fall of Pompeii and the fire of Vesuvius. And or the eruption of Vesuvius that basically decimated Pompeii and also, why am I blanking on the other city? Not Herculaneum. Whatever, the other city.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I can't believe I'm blanking on it. right, this is bad.
I just want to get a little more into Pompeii. Was Pliny the Elder a character in any of the... Was he... Because he...
Yeah.
He, like, wrote the famous account of...
Right. Pliny the Elder was a minor character in the play, in the sense that at the end of the show, they all come back... All the characters have come back as ghosts.
Oh, nice.
And so the whole thing is basically a recounting of their history.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the bakers and the citizens of Rome and those who believed in the god... It was a little Jor-El-ish, in that the primary character was not named Pliny, was... a scientist and a geologist who is assessing data and forecasting the eruption of the volcano and the destruction of the town, and everyone's going, no, the gods will protect us, and so it was a little bit like Jor-El Superman. As it relates to artistry, what I did smartly was I got connected to the Playwright Center, and in 2002-2003 I had no idea the Playwright Center existed, and I walked in and I'm like, oh man, here are all some these amazing grant-funded emerging playwrights. So people I worked with were Vincent Delaney, Alison Moore, Colin Swanson, Trista Baldwin. I worked with some amazing playwrights, and it was such an incredible encounter and association, because they really told me and instructed me how to elevate the game. You know, these weren't teachers who wanted to play playwrights. These weren't, you know, educators who wanted to supplement with playwriting. These were playwrights first who said, if we're going to do this, they want to do this right. And, you know, the first play I did was with Vincent Delaney. And he brought in a play that, he brought in a play that I'm like, this could be performed by adults for adults. It was so fun. And we got it in the hands of the kids, and they loved it. And that's when I realized you don't have to talk down to kids. You can do smart, inventive, witty plays that have some emotional depth to them. And so the first play we did was called The Great Northern Railroad, about expanding westward. These kids loved it. And so as it related to sort of pratfalls of parenting, even though I wasn't a parent, it's like, at the time, what you realize is that if you are didactic towards kids, or if you want to dumb down things for kids, they will recognize it. They have this instant sort of like dumb down smell test.
Yeah.
And they knew. They just know. And when they got this stuff in their hands, they're like, this is good. And they told us. They're like, the kids told us a lot of scripts and plays that they bought were garbage. And this had real metal to it. And it has some gravitas in the dialogue and the action. And when the music came together, it was like, oh man, home run. So from there, I ended up building over the course of time 12 full-length musicals. Full-length meaning like 40 to 60 minutes. You know, the younger kids can't do 60 minutes.
Yeah, it's long for them.
And it worked. And, we distributed everywhere around the country. And I got even to some schools out of the country. You know, like State Department overseas schools that bought. And it was amazing. I had a great ride, and ultimately I got out of it when Dramatic Publishing picked up the catalog. So I spent about another 2 years in another theatrical consulting partnership. Thankfully, through that, I was tasked to originate a full-length... Well, it ended up being a one-act musical that we got tasked to originate and bring to Las Vegas, which we did.
And that was not for education?
That was for adults. Straight performing. Right. But that's when I was married, and we were getting ready for our first kid. And at that time, I was like, man, the bug just came back even stronger. And, you know, recently I heard somebody comment, like, theater kids, you just have it in your blood. Man, I have it in my blood. And even though I was doing this stuff for a company, and I wasn't doing... I ended up writing a bunch of the shows myself, doing the plays and the music. So I guess in a roundabout, long-winded way of answering your question, it went from doing only a third of the work to probably about two-thirds of the work.
Yeah. And it sounds like some of that was because you wanted to, not because you needed to.
It was in
to.
My blood.
Like you wanted to do that.
Yeah. It's like it got to the point where I just had this phenomenal idea for a show about Jamestown.
Yeah.
And there was a show called disappearance at Jamestown, 1607. And in 2007, that was the 400th anniversary of the founding of Jamestown.
Oh, nice.
So Virginia schools, they bought that up, right? And I mean, because that was just a huge quadcennial, whatever, quadricennial. And I just got the bug, and it never stopped. And so finally, when I was able to get out and rearrange my life to essentially retire from business, I'm now two and a half years of focused on playwriting.
Yeah.
My primary vocation.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you were, you know, doing musical theater work, and you decided you needed to make a stable living. And so you went into business school, and you pursued this, but you still kept finding your... I mean, you found your way into doing the business version of making musical theater, of making theater. So, like, it really does, if you look back, look like you were doing everything you could to not do that work,
right?
And you just couldn't help yourself. You would keep coming back to it.
You know, and a lot of it had to do with the experience of working at a Fortune 500 company. I have nothing bad to say about Best Buy. I'm not going to bash, and I'm certainly not going to bash the rigidity or bureaucracy of large organizations, because my experience, and I might go so as far as to say the reality based on just life observation,
mm-hmm.
is there's a universal constant, is that whenever an organization becomes large enough, we move from people to process.
Because it's too many people to focus on, you think?
I mean, you just have to become process-oriented, because you have an organization that is a function of productivity, mm-hmm. and output, and a measurement in many ways of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're a for-profit or a non-profit. So I'm not going to bash Best Buy. All I can say is it was a little stultifying for me,
yeah.
in an environment where I was putting forth creative ideas and they weren't being acted on because they weren't, you know, benefiting, you know, the enlargement of profits. It's like, great, that's what it is.
Yeah.
I tried really hard for a year and a half. I went, man, I'm just going to direct my own thing.
Yeah.
And I left.
And I bet they probably weren't crazy about your idea about putting every meeting to music. They probably thought that
they just thought the bongos were a bit much.
Not helpful. I think most of the time, the bongos are a bit much. Right, I think you'll find that even in...
Less bongos.
We need less bongos.
Less bongos.
Unless
you're going salsa or merengue dancing, and then...
Yeah, then it's probably...
It's a staple.
We could use a little more bongo.
Right. Turn up the bongo.
He's going to turn up the bongo.
Right. Somewhere in Mexico, there's a facsimile of the Saturday Night Live skit, and there's a Christopher Walken lookalike, like Senor Walkeno, that's going, more bongos!
I really want you to write a play called Turn Up the Bongo.
Turn Up the Bongos.
But really gritty, and it's got race relations. Like, I don't know what to, you know.
Societal decay.
I want you to put that on your to-do list.
I will do that. That's funny.
You know, put a year into research about
that's funny.
How bongos are used, what they mean, you know, get at all that stuff.
I'm going to do that. That's
I'm
hilarious.
Just going to announce that's happening for everyone.
I'm going to call you for all my funny.
Deal.
Right.
So you have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yeah.
And were you already had is your son the 3-year-old? I'm sorry.
He's one.
Your son's one and your daughter's 3.
Right.
So you already had your daughter and you decided full-time playwright?
Yes, sir.
You made that
move?
That's
right. Yeah, yeah.
Did you feel both sort of nervous about making that change from a stability standpoint? / did you feel compelled to sort of follow who you were becoming a dad? I mean, was there anything happening, like, when you became a dad, did it influence your decision to, I have to go in this direction, both I shouldn't or I should?
Yeah.
Clunky question.
Good question. Good setup. The hardship of the transition was less about stability and more about family understanding.
Oh, okay.
If you came home and told Laura that you want to
live wife.
Your lovely wife, who I haven't seen in some time, but if she listens to this, hi, Laura. if you told her you wanted to get into stenography or spelunking or something that is arcane and begins with S, right? I'm on a literative kick here, right? But if you wanted to...
Stippling. It's a thing.
And she'd just probably go, what? Like... She's an artist. She spends her time in the arts career. It's not so much about stability. It's just, I don't understand what that is.
Mm-hmm.
So my incredibly beautiful and wonderful wife, it wasn't a question of, like, economics with playwriting. Mm-hmm. It was just more, I don't understand what that is, and isn't that a hobby?
Mm.
So those weren't her words.
No, yeah.
But it's more like, isn't that something you do, like, an hour a day after the kids go to sleep? most, you know, playwriting is not such a widespread occupation that people understand what
yeah, you
it
takes. Don't, not a lot of people just know a playwright.
Right, they're like, don't you do that in 3 weeks and move on to the next thing? I'm like, yeah, one takes about a year to get together. And it's a lot. It's a lot of work. And people don't realize it because they just think, you know, like most serialized, you know, forms of narrative literature, it's like that's outside of, you know, novel format. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, well, you just write like a magazine article and move on, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think people recognize novel writers, you know, fiction writers of long form, or even nonfiction long form, that there is, you know, a year of lead.
Right.
You know, minimum for some of these books. And so for playwriting, though, because they're somewhat short and they're deliverable, you know, 90 to 120 minutes, I just don't think there was an understanding of how does this fill up your day?
Yeah.
You know? And now I think there's an understanding. It's like, oh, this is not easy work. I will go as far to say that in terms of my professional career, the two hardest things, there's a tie, two-way tie for first place, of the most complicated, arduous, overwhelming task that I've ever had to perform professionally. The first is figuring out payroll tax. And the second is writing a good full-length play.
Hmm.
Those two combined don't even come close to the hardest personal thing I've ever done in my personal life, which is being a good dad.
Hmm.
Being a good dad is just so hard, and I don't think I'm great at it because I don't have any patience. My wife has all the patience. Right now, I'm not a good dad. I think I'll be a good dad once I get past... They can dress themselves, they can go to the bathroom by themselves, they can feed themselves, and I can, like, engage with them in dialogue.
Yeah.
But I just don't have a lot of patience.
Well, I'm curious if you... Do you feel like you're a good playwright? Like, internally, do you feel, like, good or even great? Like, is that something you feel like, I'm mastering this?
I was bad when I started, and I'm good now. I'm not great. I went... No. I'll let people judge whether I'm great.
But you know what you're doing.
I know what I'm doing now.
And you know how it works.
Yes.
And you feel like you can make a... You can work on a play, write a play, get to a point of completion. You know how that feels. And,
yes.
But for the fatherhood piece, you still feel like you're working on the mechanics of it?
Oh, yeah.
Like it was the early stages of writing a play. Like, I'm still figuring out what I'm supposed to be doing right now.
So in comparison, right? Because people who are listening to this are artists, right? Theater is a couple thousand-year-old art form, right? That has a lot of characteristics that have been detailed. It's a teachable art form.
Mm-hmm.
It's concrete. There's like finite elements to it, right? Even though people are still trying to push the limits of it today, if you wanted to give a class, you wanted, you know, to talk about dramatic form or theater, there's 2,000 years of form to it, right? Parenting is probably the same way. There's thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah,
of, here's how you do it.
Manuals and books.
I can read all those, and here I am working on it, and I still don't know what I'm doing. That's the pratfall, right? I mean, like, parenting's like, I still don't know what I'm doing. I am 3 years, 3.5 years into it, and I'm like, man, I'm just screwing this up every day.
But you feel like there's going to come a point, because I absolutely have that where I, obviously it's a very important job. Like, I want to be a phenomenal dad.
Yeah.
But I'm not certain that I'll ever feel like I am that. Like, I don't know. I think I maybe have created an unachievable goal of.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I mean, do you have a concrete idea of what success as a father means? That's a big question, and I didn't even know I was getting asked that one.
It's a good question.
Because I don't know if I can answer it.
So my measurements of success at this point, because I feel like I'm doing a bad job, my measurement of success is time and dedication and awareness. So I try to be there for my kids when they wake up. I try to be there for my kids when they go to bed. And I'm like 95% on with this.
Yeah.
You know, they wake up, I'm there. When they go to bed, I'm there. If there's a problem in the middle of the night, I'm there. My wife and I are, you know, we're there.
Yeah.
When they have activities at night or on the weekend, I'm there. I take my daughter to school 3 days a week. I'm on the parent advisory committee. I'm you know, playing in her big class play, I'm there. I talk to her every day about what's going on at school. Like, I just try to be focused and dedicated and aware of what's going on in their lives. When it comes to guiding them, you know, instilling them with values, right, whatever they are, you know, I mean, behaviorally, I'm like, man, I don't know if what I'm doing is correct. And then at the same time, I just sort of turn it all over to, man, this finding success as a parent, or what's my metric of success. It's like, they're just influenced by so many things outside my control. Mm-hmm. My 3-year-old has mastered the iPad.
Yeah.
She's got YouTube playlists that she builds. She like goes out and finds things from all over the world of people that are like having parties in their backyard, like pool parties in their backyard, to like airplanes landing in Los Angeles airport. So it's like, she's just got stuff that she's finding. Like, parents are like, oh, I will never put my kid in front of the TV. Mm-hmm. Like, success, right? If that's a success metric,
sure.
Good. I've reached that, because she's all over. They don't even know what TV is. Uh-huh. They're like, where's the iPad?
Yeah.
And
which is totally different.
Oh, my God. And so I'm like sitting there watching her, you know, and I try to like talk to her about it. Like, if she's watching video, and I'm like, oh, do you think that's a good choice? Is that a bad choice? Do you think that's safe? She goes, Daddy, go away. I'm watching this. Okay. So here I am as a parent. I'm like, am I successful, right? The other day, she's 3. The other day, we're pulling onto the highway through one of those, you know, like lighted entrance ramps.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, we're a little late. I'll just go right through the red. Back seat. She goes, Daddy, you ran the red light. And I said, well, the other one was green. She goes, no, it wasn't. Yeah, I'm a failure, right? And so it's like, I don't, you know, the measurements of success, I just, it's like parent, like contact time. Like, I'm just always trying to be there for them and always trying to pay attention and talk to them about their activities. Mm-hmm. But
that, it's funny, the description you have there really does, to me, there's, you know, a lot of writing books and a lot of writers I know talk about this idea of creating a practice, you know, have a word count or a page count that you want to do every day or whatever, you know, you need to create a habit of it. And that sounds like almost exactly what you described. Like, I need to at least do this. Like, I need to be there for this part and that part and show up for these things and create a parenting practice.
Right.
Around which then you can develop the sort of richer skills of your values and enrichment. I mean, that sounds to me very relatable to that idea of how a writer structures their life to get work done.
Yeah.
Because there's no really, there is no external, like, aside from your kids just telling you they need you, you have to build a structure because it's not going to build itself.
You know, it's a good observation. And I'll state something that's a personal belief, which may seem heretical to a lot of writer audiences or creator audiences. Sure. And that might earn me downer points with a lot of people.
I hope you get some negative feedback on what you're going to say, but.
So, art, mostly creationist art, and I'll make an allegory to jazz, because I played a lot of music in my life, and in a lot in the jazz idiom. Jazz artists, it's an artistic form where self preoccupation is a large facet.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's not for the audience.
Right.
Kind of what
they're up there playing for themselves and worried about the art that they're creating. It's not an art form where you're going out saying, did we entertain or enlighten the audience, or do we need to change things for the audience's sake, right? Mm-hmm. I feel that a lot of the creationists in art function that way because of their art.
Art creators, right?
Right, art creators.
You're talking about the creationism in a religious context.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. Right. That's a good point.
I know what you're saying, creators. But I just wanted to make sure that was...
Right. Small c, not big c.
Right.
Like, lowercase c, creationists.
Right.
People who create.
Yeah.
Probably, well, I won't say probably, because this is my belief.
Go ahead.
Creationists, small, lowercase c, follow that self-absorbed, self-preoccupied world, and as a result, they try to tie that to parenting. And here's what I've observed. If I was to stop creating my art today, tomorrow, I don't know how many people would really care.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I all of a sudden, like, because I think, oh, my art, I've been working so hard on this. This is, I've got a statement to look at my catalog of work, and I'm building all this, and this is so important. The world needs to hear this. You know what? If I stop writing tomorrow, mm-hmm. how many people would care? Mm-hmm. But if I stop being a dad tomorrow, there are two people that would suffer very, very, you know, badly from mm-hmm. that. And so for all the people who are out there who are listening.
And arguably your wife as well.
Right. Arguably. Maybe. She might go, Sam, where'd Sam go?
That's a load off. Yeah.
Sweet. And I can get what I need to get done. Yeah. But for the people out there who are like, who think, man, my artwork or what I'm creating is so important, and, you know, how do I work in my kids with that?
Yeah.
Let me just tell for the listening audience. There are teachers, roofers. Mm. There are tons of vocationists out there, you know, all the way from higher income, lower income strata, you know, lawyers and whatever, that go to work every day and work hard, and who consider it their life's work because that's the vocation that they chose or the career that they're, mm-hmm. you know, pursuing. But if they don't have any belief that, what I'm doing is the most important thing ever and everybody in the world needs to see what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Most of them, right, will go, being a good dad is more important.
Sure.
And so I try to put that in perspective of my work to go, yeah, you know what? My writing is important to me.
Yeah.
And I believe I have something to say, and I'm saying it well and in an artistic construct and all that stuff. But my parenting is much more important.
Sure, sure.
And so possibly the biggest pratfall is believing that your work as an artist comes before your work as a parent.
Mm.
In terms of priority, and I would be crushed if I woke up tomorrow and I found out for some reason I couldn't continue playwriting.
Yeah.
But I have to go, look, what the most important thing is raising my kids and developing my kids. That's more important to the world.
Yeah.
So for all the people out there who are listening who go, screw you, Sam Graber, I never want to talk to you again, or what you're speaking, you know, you preach the devilry.
I'll post an email address where people can send those messages
right.
in.
Just be like, get on Sam. You know, I go, well, you disagree with me, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I think it to be true. I think it to be a true.
Well, I have.
How do you respond to that? I mean, I know this is an interview about me, and I'm not supposed to be interviewing the interviewer.
No, it's fine. This is a really sort of relevant to my life topic as well. In that, I am sort of have an ongoing struggle with how much time I put into my various creative art projects. You know, I have a bunch of different things going on. I'm making shows and producing things and working on stuff. I have a full-time regular job for income and insurance purposes.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I have a daughter who I love, and she's my favorite person I've ever met on the planet. Like, she's awesome, and I get more from her than I give to her already. You know, all that stuff is true. And so I have had moments where I'm like, why am I doing all these other projects? Is it taking away time from, even if I do it after she's in bed, then I'm more tired when I'm with her. You know,
right.
I still make, my time is the time with her. And then particularly my wife will make this argument. She'll say, part of the reason you need to do the work you care about is because it makes you a better person and a better father if you are doing something that matters to you. So the work isn't more important than my daughter. But me doing the work mm-hmm. makes me more capable of being sort of like a good model of how someone can lead a life that's fulfilling for them.
Correct.
And to be in a better headspace with, you know, like, instead of just being resentful and frustrated that I'm not doing, mm-hmm. you know, because as much as I know my time with her is the primary, there's a part of my brain that is still like, I'm not doing things I care about. So if I am, then it makes that time with her more rich for me, and she can feel that too.
Yep.
Make some sense?
You know,
to you?
Some people will even equate that to exercise.
Oh yeah, it is.
They'll say,
it's the same
if thing. I don't get out and if I don't exercise, I cannot be with my kids. I have to have my time and my space so I can clear my head.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I would argue, and you might agree with me, that working as an artist and as a creator has a lot more. Has a lot more long passing impact on you and your psyche and your emotional abilities and your, you know, all that's going on in the world than just going to a gym and moving around weight, and you can transfer that to your kids, right?
But you look good in those mirrors.
I'm just
the curls going. I don't know why you're wearing a sleeveless shirt.
I got
what I'm trying to say.
Right. And
see,
the tight black
so no one
pants,
knows.
Tight black leather pants. No, but it's like, it's just for me as a parent, what I try to do is I try to say, look, the priority is around my kids. Mm-hmm. And the question I'd ask myself is, if something happened where I, for whatever reason, for you brought up like income, if for whatever reason I had to change because of a need for the kid.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I would do it overnight. Yeah. They're like, look, I have to give up playwriting and I have to go do something else because it needs to be done for the kids. It's like, I'm going to do that because my kids are just more important.
I mean, maybe I'm modeling. I feel like that's probably the bulk of anybody would right. make that move. I mean, my mother did those kinds of choices constantly. Mm-hmm. She's like, I got to do what my kids need, whether or not it's, you know, we need money right now. Right. And I feel like I've made those. I mean, I'm making those choices all the time.
Right.
I'm sure you're sometimes deciding if which project or where to go. Well, you have to make those choices right. based on how it impacts the people
right.
in your life.
I'm speaking in terms of rationalizing how I merge
right.
my craft with parenting.
Yeah.
And what I've done is I've said I have to keep them separate
yeah.
because the kids are more important. And even though, you know, I've got theater in my blood and playwriting in my blood, at this stage, my kids need me, and that's where my priority is.
Yeah, well, and it seems like you've been able to figure out how to, you can do your work, and
yeah.
you can be your dad, and it doesn't seem like it is a tremendous conflict for you. You're not
right.
You're not wrestling for time spent or anything.
No.
I mean, you seem to balance that well.
Yeah.
But do you feel like you have some obligation as a dad to model, I don't know, doing things you care about? Like that? Do you think of, you know, your kid's 3 and 1 right now, probably not terribly interested or aware of what else you do, you know, if you're not bringing them something, or if you're mostly either interrupting them when they're on the iPad.
Right.
But do you feel like down the road, part of your job is to show them how to be a fulfilled adult?
Sure.
You know, like, does that make you feel good about doing work?
That's a great question. That is an awesome question. My behavior modeling for the kids has nothing to do with my artistry.
Hmm.
It has to do with how I interact with other adults, how I conduct myself in society, the tone of my voice if I get upset about something.
Yeah. That's a tough one for me.
Oh, yeah, because I have no pain. I'm just terrible.
Well, you can't lie. In yeah. those moments, you can't trick your voice into hiding how frustrated you are.
In a grand scheme, how we acquire and deal with assets and you know, because we live in houses and we have
yeah.
items, and when we go shopping and when we see people that are less fortunate. I mean, my wife and I have a date night. We go out and we volunteer.
Hmm.
When we're with our kids and we see something happen, we talk about, should we help? Should we, you know, those are the things that, to me, I try to model. As it relates to my work, you know, my kids came and saw me once. I mean, you know, I work out of the library.
Hmm.
I spend a lot of my time in the library. It's not at Barnes & Noble. I think really good food at the cafe. But, you know, and they come and see
me. This episode brought to you by Barnes & Noble.
Right. They come and see me work. They would just see me, you know, banging my head against the table going, why is this not working? Why is this scene not working? Why is this scene not working? Someday, they're going to see my stuff on stage. And my goal, actually, of why I write plays is not so much for my kids, but for my grandkids.
Hmm.
I want 100 years from now, you know, I'll be gone, unless there's a magic
come on, science.
It, you know, come yeah. on! But I'll be 100 years from now, my kids are going to, our grandkids or my great grandkids are going to go, who is my great grandfather?
Hmm.
And they're going to see all these plays and pick it up and go, this is who he was.
Yeah.
I mean, my grandfather was a professional artist. He
What kind of work did he
watercolors okay. and murals, and we just have his artwork all over the house. I mean, he still lives through his art, and my kids, his great grandkids, are going to get to know him through his work.
Yeah,
so it's kind of a testament to my life, and so my great grandkids, in a way, they're going to see me and see me fulfilled through my work.
Hmm.
And but in terms of modeling myself, you know, I'm not a performance-based artist as a playwright. I mean, with the music that I still do, yeah, they've come out and seen me play music, and they watch me for 5 minutes, and then they're like, okay, where's the ice cream? They like to could care less I'm out there playing and singing. They're like, yeah, where's the ice cream?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess the last 10 minutes, and I'm not trying to downplay the role in society of playwrights or the role in society of artists, which, you know, I believe is enormous and influential and critical. I'm just trying to downplay, I guess, how I feel about playwriting overall in my house and artistry overall in my house and my relations with my kids. Because I just don't want to overthink that my work is so important or the work of the artist is so grandiose in society that you go, well, it's just... It just supersedes my role as a parent. And I guess, you know, to summarize or to as a summation to your question about do they see me getting fulfillment? Yeah, I get fulfillment in life from a variety of things, and I don't feel like I have to behavior model or model my profession to pass on to them what I consider to be positive values impacting society.
Yeah, well, that makes me wonder if... what you saw from your parents as far as like did they do artistic things and also did they do work that you were aware of that they were interested in?
Man, that is an awesome question. So my mom was a third grade teacher for 25 years and my dad spent his entire career working as an animal scientist for the Center of Veterinary Medicine inside the FDA. Nice. We would go on trips and we would go, I mean, no matter where we went, somebody would know my dad. And man, you know, we were going to sort of farming towns and people knew him as like the lead animal nutritionist for foods that animals were intaking. He was basically the front line for whatever animals we eat.
Okay, sure.
And people knew him. And it was like, we'd go places like, Dad is, man, everybody knows you. But we never saw him sitting in a barn like, sampling or testing data.
Yeah, you just felt the impact he had on people.
Right, and I rarely would, like, see my mom in the classroom. But I'll tell you what, you know, like, every year on Rosh Hashanah, I'll chant the Torah in temple. I get more, like, accolades and attaboys from doing that than I do from playwriting. And, you know, in some ways, if my kids see that, like, here's Dad contributing to the community through a very small work, which is just chanting of the Torah, although it's a specialized skill and you have to like get trained, you have to know how to do it.
Yeah.
But they see me doing that, and in some ways that's more prideful at this stage. But when they get older, they get to be like teenagers and they're thinking about the world and whether they want to go to college or where they want to go to college. Man, I hope my writing at that point, they go out and see some of my plays, they're like, man, Dad's saying something.
Yeah.
You know, because it's an intellectual pursuit.
Well, and you talked about that experience of seeing people know your dad.
Yeah.
That seems like that could happen. You know, there's going to be a whole crew of people who have worked on producing some of your shows.
Yeah.
So there's a likelihood that your kids someday could be with you and someone will go, hey, I saw your play, or hey, I worked on, you know, the play with your dad. Like, they might get that. You may have created a context where they can have a similar experience to what you had with your dad going around town. And
unfortunately, at that point, my kids will be teenagers.
Yeah, they won't care.
Where's the drugs? Right. You know, go buy me beer. You know, so let's steal their car. So, you know, it's like,
awful
great.
Teenagers, it sounds like.
Right. They're going to just be awful. No.
Drunk car thieves.
You know, they'll be smoking synthetic meth, you know, with one hand while keeping their other hand from, like, you know, like, you know, not letting, you know, the, you know, illegal contraband spill all over their pit bulls in the backseat or something.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a RoboCop scenario that you've described.
I'm just like, great. So, yeah, but they don't get to see me work.
But it does sound like they could eventually see what your work means to people.
Right.
The way you got to see what your dad's work means.
Right.
Meant to those people.
Right.
Which I think is, that looking forward could be awesome. Maybe it won't happen at all and it won't matter. And I'm sure that's not why your dad did that work. Like, I'm sure he wasn't, you know, I'm going to take care of these horses so someday these people will praise me in front of my son.
Right.
That doesn't motivate anybody.
The feeder of equines.
I think that's really cool that you got to have those experiences growing up, and it can affect how you view your
face. And maybe this dialogue in some ways is, you know, you're providing advice to me, or you're counseling me to say, look, you get your daughter gets to see you perform and it provides you with some value. So maybe in the way it's like, Sam, wake up, because 10 to 15 years from now, it will provide value for you as well. And maybe I was wrong with my initial statement.
No, I'm not arguing at all.
I'm often wrong, but I'm never in doubt, right? And I'm kidding. I'm a very flexible and humble.
Yeah,
writer.
No, I don't think you're. I wouldn't worry about that at all. No, I like hearing that story. Like, I'm curious if your folks
They never encouraged me to get into artistry. Mm-hmm. They never encouraged me to become a playwright. They never encouraged me to get into theater.
But did they discourage?
They didn't discourage it. And they were, certainly were not artistic themselves. I did get to see a lot of stuff at, you know, Arena growing up. Mm. And we went to a lot of, you know, theatrical performances, Kennedy Center. But it wasn't because of them that they encouraged me to get into this work.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. So, but they did a lot of work with me as parents.
You know?
I mean, they were just great parents, and I had a great childhood. Thankfully, I grew up at probably the right time in our history. You know, I wasn't growing up in a war zone, or I wasn't, you know, in the pogroms in Russia or anything, which is where my grandparents and great-grandparents escaped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've never been displaced. I've never been moved. I've never been marginalized. I've never been hostilized. I mean, there wasn't any, like, barbaric actions against me. Mm-hmm. We never felt like our security was compromised or our peace of mind was infringed, right? So I grew up in a part of the historic timeline. I mean, I was 6 years old when Miracle on Ice happened. Mm. You know, the country's just, my childhood, it was positive. Mm. It was the Go-Go's era.
Yeah.
Not the Go-Go. Although the Go-Go's didn't exist.
Era. Yeah.
You know, but it was the Go-Go's era. And so there was a lot of positive impact on my childhood, which both in my house and then in the world surrounding, and the United States position, as a solid superpower that, you know, continued to, I guess, enlarge its dominance in the world with, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union. Now I look at the world differently because, as it relates to parenting my kids, in some ways, as I've gotten older, I worry about a United States clinging to a falsehood of enduring superiority.
Mm.
And its position in the world. You know, here we are 100 years plus after sort of, you know, expanding through imperialism. And you see what's going on with the economy and what's going on with just the divisiveness. And you go, what's it going to be like for my kids when they get old enough to be 6 years old, 8 years old? And they go, what's the United States? Where are we in the world? So I try to focus my parenting I think I'll be a better, I guess what I'm trying to say is I think I'll be a better parent for them when we're old enough to dialogue this stuff versus, mm. no, put your finger there. No, take that down. No, he found it first. Yeah. No, put that. I mean, I feel like my skills as a parent are inadequate.
Yeah, it sounds like you're waiting for times when you can discuss abstract concepts
right.
instead of just watch out.
Right.
And that's a hard waiting period.
Right.
There's a ton of other stuff I would talk about. I mean, I really enjoy talking about this stuff. But I've used a lot of your time. I do this thing that you're aware of at the end where I have this book from 100 years ago.
And I mentioned 100 years ago. Look at this.
I like to read a chunk from it.
Okay.
And, so we'll see if this applies to your life in any way or
okay.
if you could use it.
And so, this is 100 years ago?
It's from 1910. So awesome. It's Practical Suggestions for Mother and Housewife.
Killing here.
Thought it would totally apply to you.
Right.
So
Mothers and Housewives?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It says...
I love them both.
It is a social instinct to conform to the custom of one's fellow. And the children have reached the age of consent in matters of fashion. Their fathers and mothers may lend their influence to abolish foolish customs or to modify them in the direction of wisdom, but it's best that this be in their capacity as citizens and not as parents. So to unpack that a little bit, I think it's saying you can't tell your kids what to,
I heard it.
To wear at a certain point. Is that what you take out of that?
So here's what's different. When we were growing up, was it not like, hey, I'm going to go out and I'm just going to go, all my friends, and we're just going to go meet up at the park and play?
I think so, yeah.
Dude, I mean, was my life was happened. Just sports every day after school, and my parents didn't come and watch us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like all the neighborhood kids would just get together, not only go to the neighborhood park, but we would go in the forest. We would just be all over the place. Like... wide range of kids. There mm-hmm. there wasn't like, I'm going to watch you. And I feel like today, even if my kids are older, we just don't live in neighborhoods like that anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong. But just from everybody I talk to who's got kids at a variety of age levels, there is no more, just go out of the house and meet up with everybody in the neighborhood and just go play somewhere and come back in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So as I listen to that, excellent passage. Good selection from you. You know, it's like it's easier to follow through on the modifying or the abolishing of other norms in the neighborhood because we're just more watchful of our kids because we're more protectionary of them. We're at the ball fields with them. We're at the activities with them versus just go out.
Yeah.
And so it's different because we're not letting our kids figure things out as much as you just go down to the park and stay away from the older kids and don't get beat up. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like we just, you know, I figured out so much of the stuff on my own, running around on our bikes and cavorting. And so that, you know, that the passage as it gets to is, as a parent, am I functioning more as a citizen than a parent, thinking more about how is this kid growing up in society? I just think about it from a practical perspective of we don't have a choice because we're just not letting our kids go out and do things by themselves.
I wonder, you know, is that
a salient point? I mean,
no, I think so, but it made me think of at the beginning of our conversation, you were talking about your daughter's proficiency with the iPad.
Yeah.
I wonder if that, the internet has become the playground where you can go meet a bunch of random
point.
People.
That's a great point.
And that's where those influences happen now.
Super point, man.
And then what do you do? I mean, there's, you know, child protection controls, but in a way, I think there is, it seems like there's actual research behind less go out and play random stuff. But now the world is actually smaller because you can connect with someone in Bulgaria online when you're six.
Yeah.
And not even really comprehend where they are, but you can connect with them in whatever weird way that might be.
That's a great point, and it's very true.
And I don't know what that means for the future. I think it's great. It's terrifying. You know, it's a combination of those things. I don't really know.
Yeah. I'll say, come back at you. I don't find it terrifying. I find it very liberating.
It's that, yeah.
And I find it, you know, with my daughter right now, she will find stuff from England and Bulgaria, Romania, and you know, it's good for us to talk about it.
Sure, certainly.
But you do see a lot of similarities in the cultural norms. I just as it relates to the passage, my initial instinct is only just the generational change, and that we're not out at you've got great enlightenment here. We're not out at a physical playground in the neighborhood. There's a virtual playground, and how do we function as citizens? And it's no longer just our country. It's citizens of the world. I mean,
you said, you know, the U.S. is clearly not the superpower it once thought of itself as, but that can be a positive. And it seems like the way to connect online is to have there be less boundaries, you know, between countries or whatever. I don't know what the dividing lines are anymore.
Yeah.
Who does and doesn't have a computer?
Before we go, shameless plugs.
Yeah, please. Yeah, where can people find your stuff?
I have two plays going up. I've been insane. I have three new plays going up for three different theater companies next year.
Awesome.
Wish me luck. Two will be in town. One is going to be with Box Wine Theater. It's a play called What Happened to the Dollar? A zany look at the fall of the dollar.
Nice. And where do you know where that's going to be produced?
I don't. Okay.
But Box Wine has a website, and I'm sure it'll be on there.
Yeah, they're talking about Bryant Lake Bowl.
Okay.
The second is going to be next fall. It's a play called Modern Prophet. It's going to be done with Mission Theater.
Okay.
And the third play is going to be out of town, but it's called Shooter. It's about an office shooting.
Nice. And then is there a good place for people to know just what you're up like to... Is there a good central online location for anything you're working on?
I wish there was. Thank you for going there. I wish I had a web destination.
Well, I want you to feel bad. That's why I brought it up.
It's shaming. Shame. I'm working on a website. I've gotten a bunch of plays that are now getting... I mean, I'm going to New York next month. There's a festival that picked up one of my shorts. And then I just found out last night another festival picked up another one of my shorts in New York. So I'm getting to the point where there's enough catalog and there's enough strong showings, so I'm like, yeah, maybe I should have my own website so that people can see here's all the plays and it's set up well. So I'm going to get that up soon. But, you know, in the meantime, call me. But I want to thank you. You do a great job with this podcast.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
You have a lot of great people on it, and you're really doing a service for the artistic community by, you know, having a forum for people to just to touch in and tap into. It's great work by you.
Well, now you're making me uncomfortable, so we're going to end. But I do. I really want to thank you, Sam, the grabber, Graber, for joining me. I appreciate your time and your openness and everything.
Cool.
And I want to thank everybody for listening.
Thank you, guys.
Pratfalls of Parenting theme music by Anna Wegel. Pratfalls of Parenting is a Comedy Suitcase production.